Blog Talk Radio.
Wow, what a week. Markets gyrating all over the place. And, you know, the Dow, the indexes dropping, rising. We've got the Fed meeting in Jackson Hole. We've got Venezuela on the brink of starvation. We've got China, a complete mess, and presidential candidates all coming out with their views on China. Lots and lots and lots to talk about. You're listening to the Aaron Brooks Show. We're going to talk about a lot of these things this afternoon. You're all encouraged to call in 347-324-3075 with any thoughts you have on any of these issues. But I want to start this morning or this afternoon. I want to start with something that happened on Monday that might have gotten Tim Cook, the CEO of Apple, into deep problems with the regulators, with the SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission. So what happened? Well, if you remember Monday, seems like a long time ago if you've been following the markets, but Monday the market opened way, way, way down. And Apple stock indeed opened under 100. And the CEO of Apple, Tim Cook, emailed Cramer. Now, I could tell you a lot about Jim Cramer at CNBC, but this isn't the time. Anyway, Jim Cramer, not one of my favorite financial analysts. He's an idiot in my view. But anyway, Jim Cramer, he emailed Jim Cramer and basically let him know that in a private email, that Apple didn't see much slowdown in China. That is, Apple sales in China were pretty strong and pretty good because there was all this discussion. The market tumbled. There's all this discussion about the economic woes in China, economic problems, and that, of course, reverberates onto companies like Apple and other companies that do a lot of business in China. And all those company stocks were being pounded, as were the rest of the stock market, was just being decimated by this news of economic weakness in China and its implications on the United States, particularly given the fact that the Federal Reserve is thinking about raising interest rates. So Tim Cook sends this private email. Hey, Cramer, we're seeing strong growth in China for the last 2 months, right? And the iPhone activations have been accelerating. And really, Chinese App Store has seen record performance. So not long after the email goes out to Cramer, CNBC's anchor posts the email to Twitter and also announces it on television, on CNBC, that this is what Apple CEO has said. And immediately, this raised alarm bells because technically, Tim Cook has violated SEC Regulation FD. And Regulation FD, which prohibits publicly traded companies from disclosing material company information privately without simultaneously releasing it publicly. So as a publicly traded CEO, you are not allowed to give any information to any private entity, a private entity that might be a market professional or holder of your stock, and who could, it doesn't matter if they do or not, who could trade on the basis of this information without at exactly the same time releasing this information publicly. Wow, right? I mean, I don't know how many of you knew that this regulation existed, but it basically says that if you meet with a journalist as the CEO of a company, you cannot say anything privately, particularly if this journalist is a market professional and might own shares of your stock without simultaneously disclosing it publicly, letting the rest of the world know. You can't take a phone call from an analyst without simultaneously and talk about something that you haven't already disclosed. So why would analysts even call you? Why would you take a call from an analyst? You've got nothing to tell them. All you can tell them is, you know everything I know because it's all public information, and I can't tell you anything else because otherwise I'd be violating Regulation Q. I'd be violating the rules. So in this case, Tim Cook let a financial professional, Cramer, who probably owns stock, if he doesn't, he advises people who own stock in Apple, without at the same time making that information public. Now, the complication here, of course, is that Jim Cramer is also, in a sense, a journalist. And by letting Jim Cramer know this information, Tim Cook was, in a sense, making it public because he assumed that Cramer would then announce it publicly to everybody else. But he didn't know that would happen. And we don't know if Jim Cramer didn't trade on that information seconds before. Of course, he would then be tried for inside information, for trading on inside information. The whole thing is so convoluted and complex and bizarre and ridiculous. Anyway, everybody's watching now to see whether the SEC is going to launch an investigation into a violation of Regulation FD by Tim Cook during this whole thing. Now, why do I bring this up? Because this is just a minor story within a pretty crazy week. Because I want to spend some time today, and we'll be doing this kind of a regular basis. We'll make this a regular feature of the Aaron Brooks Show on Blog Talk Radio. And by the way, you can call in 347-324-3075 if you have any views on what Tim Cook did on Jim Cramer on CNBC and generally on the market volatility of this last week and what it represents. We'll get into a lot more of that. But as a regular corner on the Aaron Brooks Show, I'd like to make this issue of the rule of law, and in particular, the rule of law in the context of the regulatory state, because this might be the way in which we are most tyrannized. This might be the way in which we are losing freedoms faster than maybe any other way that the government is controlling us. We have become a regulatory state. Maybe we could even call it a regulatory tyranny or bureaucratic tyranny. Excuse me, I feel like I'm coming down with something. It usually happens on a Saturday right after I come back from a trip. And I feel like on these Saturdays, I feel like I'm coming down with something. So you'll excuse my voice and my coughing once in a while. But cronyism doesn't quite capture this, because this is not about cronyism. This is not about businesses manipulating the system for their own favor. This is about the arbitrary, almost unlimited power of regulators over our lives, particularly over our business lives. This is the kind of thing like Regulation FD, which is random, arbitrary, impossible to understand, impossible to know when you violate and when you don't. And as a consequence, it's possible for the regulators to sometimes go after you, sometimes not go after you. It depends. And what does it depend on? Well, the real danger here is that it depends on your political affiliation, whether you be nice to the regulators, whether you be nice to the right political parties, whether your political views. This is how freedom of speech is being curtailed. This is how political freedom is being curtailed. This is how we are becoming a tyranny. If you attack the FDA, well, will they approve the drug that you are developing? If you attack Dodd-Frank, will your bank be harassed more than other banks? And I think the answer to that, to both of those, today in the world we live in, is clear. If you're a banker, you better not speak up against the Fed. If you're a trader, you better not speak up against the SEC. If you're a hospital, a health insurance company, you better not speak up against Obamacare. If you need environmental approval for any kind of project that you have, you better not speak up. What we have today is the tyranny of regulators, the tyranny of non-objective law. And that's what I want to talk about today with regard to financial markets and banking. But this is a theme that I want to keep coming back to because, we'll try to have a regular kind of discussion of the rule of law. And let me just say that there's an excellent, excellent article about it. I don't agree with everything in this article, but that would be pretty unusual if I did. But it's excellent because it brings up dramatic, really, really important issues. The article is called Rule of Law in the Regulatory State. And it's by one of my favorite economic bloggers, John Cochrane, The Grumpy Economist. That's the name of the blog, The Grumpy Economist. And it was published on August 1st. So a few weeks ago, Rule of Law in the Regulatory State. I recommend everybody read it. We're going to go over it a little bit here. But what John Cochrane is basically identifying is the state of the world in which we're in today, a state of the world in which regulators have no checks and balances. Regulators have almost unlimited power. There is very, very little that you can do when the regulators come after you. Often the regulators themselves are the appeals court with regard to their own decisions. And these regulators are all powerful within their industries, whether it's the bank regulators, whether they're SEC, whether it's the FDA, whether it's the people in charge of Obamacare, whether it's the new Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. And there's no end to the number of regulatory agencies. There's no end to the number of pages, of regulations that keep coming out. And one of the things that John identifies, and I think absolutely accurately, is the fact that today Congress passes big, vague laws. Laws with no specificity, completely non-objective. And it really delegates the actual writing of the rules, the writing of the actual regulations, the actual things that you have to abide by to the regulatory agencies. I mean, Dodd-Frank, for example, was passed years ago, and yet not on the rules specifying what you should do, can do, cannot do, have been written, right? To date, the Volcker rule alone, which is just one aspect of the entire Dodd-Frank bill, which basically creates firewalls between your deposits and your investment side of the house for banks, the Volcker rule alone runs now nearly 1,000 pages. And, of course, it's unclear, it's non-objective, completely random. Well, I don't know if it's completely random, but it's imposing. It's very hard to tell whether you're following the rules or not following the rules, whether you're consistent with the regulations or not consistent with the regulations. And, of course, the regulators themselves wrote the rules. And one of the ways the regulators impose their power is that they invite the banks in to help them write the rules, so that the banks are then part of the process. The banks now have to buy into it. And, of course, it's the big banks, not the small banks. It's some banks, not other banks. It's part of how they distribute power It's part of how they distribute favors. It's part of how cronyism and the corruption get instituted. It's by, hey, we're writing the rules. They're going to determine whether you go out of business or not. You want to participate? You want to have a say in these? Well, of course, banks are going to want to have a say in it. All right, let's define some of what we're talking about. Laws are not objective. What does that mean? It means they're not clear. It means that you do not know in advance what is a crime and what the penalty will be if you violate that crime. You don't know in advance whether you're violating a regulation or not. You can't articulate. You're in the field. You're in the area. It's not a matter of ignorance. But you just don't know, because even reading the rules, even reading the laws, you can't tell whether you are violating them or not. They're unclear. They're non-objective. They're incomprehensible. They make some sense, that they are understandable. And of course, why would we have laws that are not objective? You remember the scene in Atlas Shrugged, and I can't quote it exactly, but it's a scene where the regulator, I think it's Ferris, comes to see, and I assume all of you read Atlas Shrugged, and if you haven't, shame on you, you should all go read Atlas Shrugged. So the scene is, I think it's Dr. Ferris and Riordan, and Ferris says to Riordan, you think we want you to follow the rules? Of course we don't want you to follow the rules. We attain power over you by writing rules that you cannot follow, by writing rules that you can't even know whether you're following or not. We get to decide whether you're following them or not. We get to decide whether you violated them or not. It's unbelievable that Ayn Rand could write this 57 years ago, and we're seeing the reality right now. You're seeing it in Regulation D. You clearly see it in insider trading laws. You have no idea whether you're following the rules or not with insider trading. The law, the courts keep changing their minds. The courts keep flipping on this. The latest insider trading prosecutions are probably going to go to the Supreme Court because they're so unclear, the rules, that nobody can actually decide what they mean and what they don't mean. So what we have today are non-objective laws guiding much of the financial industry. Much of the financial industry. And we're going to get to a big non-objective entity in a minute called the Federal Reserve and its impact on market turmoil and what's going on in the markets in a few minutes. But right now we're just focused in on the regulatory state, the rule of law. Now, in the broadest sense, the rule of law means more than laws need to be objective. It means more than, you know, placing law above men, right? That you are guided by laws that are not at the discretion of the enforcers of those laws. They have to be objective. The laws have to be knowable. It's not by permission, it's by law. All these things relate to the rule of law. But also, and this is not something I'm going to dwell on today, but we should talk about in the future, the rule of law means rules that have a purpose consistent with the role of government. Consistent with the role of government. What's the role of government? To protect our individual rights. The only purpose of government, the only role of government, is to protect our individual rights. The rule of law means laws that protect individual rights and that are objective. Regulations, which have nothing to do with the protection of individual rights, are by definition, in that sense, a violation of the rule of law. I want to focus, though, and we're going to focus, though, here on the non-objectivity of these laws, on the tyrannical nature of the laws. And of course, that is completely consistent with the fact that they violate individual rights and that they're not there to protect individual rights. All right, when we get back, We'll continue our discussion of the rule of law. We'll pick up some examples. We'll go over a little bit of this article by John Cochran, and we'll talk about the implications of all this. We'll be right back after this break.
The Ayn Rand Institute campus is an exciting online destination offering free e-courses on Ayn Rand and her revolutionary philosophy of objectivism. Whether you recently picked up your first Rand book or have been reading her novels and nonfiction for years, ARI Campus has something for you. On campus, you'll discover a variety of multimedia courses covering Rand's literary classics, specific aspects of thought, and how to apply her ideas to your life. Get started today at campus.aynrand.org. See you on campus.
With adoring fans, rabid critics, and very few in between, why does Atlas Shrugged evoke such impassioned responses? Because it grapples with the fundamental problems of human existence and it presents radically new answers. Atlas Shrugged challenges many conventional notions about good and evil, that sex is a low animal desire, that money is the root of evil, that man is sinful by nature. One of the most prominent is the notion that selfishness is evil and self-sacrifice is good. Atlas Shrugged is a dramatization of Ayn Rand's unique vision of existence and of man's highest potential. 12 years in the writing, it is her masterwork. Rand's worldview emerges in the plot turns of this compelling mystery, centered on one question: who is John Galt? There are many legends. Which of these is true? Is he the man who discovered the Fountain of Youth? The man who found the lost city of Atlantis? A modern Prometheus? Does he even exist? And why, if no one knows the answer, does the entire world know his name? Find out the answer when you read the novel that sparked a philosophical revolution. Order it today on Amazon.com.
In 1934, Ayn Rand wrote to journalist and essayist H.L. Mencken, "Perhaps it may seem a lost cause at present, and there are those who will say that I am too late, that I can only hope to be the last fighter for a mode of thinking which has no place in the future. But I do not think so. I intend to be the first one in a new battle, which the world needs as it has never needed before, the first to answer the many too many advocates of collectivism and answer them in a manner which will not be forgotten. Every day at ARI, we work to make sure that Ayn Rand's answer will not be forgotten. Help us. Contribute today at AynRand.org/support.
Meet your fellow Ayn Rand admirers from around the country for an evening celebrating the ideas of Atlas Shrugged. Join them on the evening of September 29th at the St. Regis Hotel in Manhattan for the 7th Annual Atlas Shrugged Revolution Benefit Dinner and Live Auction. More than 5 decades after its publication, Atlas Shrugged continues to influence millions of people, and each year thousands more are introduced to and forever changed by Ayn Rand's magnum opus. Find out why and how the Ayn Rand Institute is promoting Rand's ideas throughout the United States and around the world. You'll be supporting the work of the Ayn Rand Institute to encourage even more young people to read and study Ayn Rand's novels in the years ahead. Visit online at aynrand.org/NYC or call us toll free at 800-365-6552, extension 204. Seating is limited, so make sure to call or go online. That's aynrand.org/NYC or call 800-365-6552, extension 204.
Ayn Rand was a radical thinker whose philosophical novels challenged students to reconsider their views on fundamental issues. The Fountainhead, Atlas Shrugged, and Anthem. These works have become classics of American literature that never fail to engage young people and stimulate intense classroom discussion. By offering these works for free to teachers, the Ayn Rand Institute hopes to encourage greater awareness and understanding of Rand's stimulating perspective. If you're a teacher who would like Ayn Rand's books in your classroom, visit AynRand.org. This is at no cost to you. Go to AynRand.org today.
All right, you're listening to the Ron Brooks Show, and we're talking about the rule of law. We're talking about regulation and the regulatory state, the tyranny of regulations. If you want to discuss this, you have any examples of this tyrannical rule, or if you just want to discuss this issue, 347-324-3075, 347-324-3075, and we have our first caller. And let's see. Hi, you're on the Ron Brooks Show. Who's this?
Hi, this is Dave from Portland, Oregon.
Hey, Dave. How are you?
Oh, very good. Great. Great.
Is this the same Dave that calls me on the Chicago station?
It is.
You're following me around.
Well, you got great information.
Well, I appreciate it. That's great. Go ahead.
You also gave me some tips on an upcoming debate I had, which I did do on net neutrality. I wanted to say thank you. I took your advice on taking a step back, and instead of getting into all the technical details of net neutrality, I decided to take a step back and challenge the myth of public interest and really put all my energy into that. And anyway, you know, long story short, it went well. I actually won the debate and changed at least one mind in the audience to challenge the idea of the public interest.
That's terrific, because that's hard to do, and usually debates don't change people's minds that much. So congratulations, that's terrific. And that's a great issue. That's a great issue to focus a debate on.
So, yeah, thank you for that. It really made a difference.
Good. Good. So you have any questions or comment on the regulations, or you just wanted to tell me that?
Yeah, you had mentioned to give a call and mention how it went, so I wanted to follow up with that.
Oh, great. Excellent. Congratulations. Keep doing this. This is how we spread ideas, right? Only X number of people might be listening to me on the radio or reading my stuff, but then all of you guys who listen, maybe you learned something, maybe you take something away, and go spread the word, get engaged in debates, get engaged in discussions, and let's really, you know, this is how ideas spread. This is how we change people's minds. Thanks for calling, and thanks for doing a great job with the debate. We'll talk to you soon. All right, so we're talking about rule of law and the examples of what John Cochran calls bureaucratic tyranny. I actually like that, bureaucratic tyranny, which I guess is a phrase that George Nash quotes Herbert Hoover as using. So, okay, so now I've got the whole sequence, right? We've got John Cochran quoting George Nash, who was quoting Herbert Hoover. But I think it's a perfect Herbert Hoover, not one of my heroes, but a perfect illustration. This is really tyranny through regulations, through the regulatory state, through arbitrary, non-objective laws. And look, the whole purpose of government is the protection of individual rights. And how does it protect individual rights? I'm going to quote Ayn Rand from The Virtue of Selfishness, The Nature of Government in The Virtue of Selfishness. This is the task of a government, of a proper government. Its basic task, its only moral justification and reason why men do need a government. And what is that? It's to protect rights under an objective code of rules. A government, this is quoting Ayn Rand again, a government is the means of placing the retaliatory use of physical force under under objectively defined laws. You cannot defend individual rights. Indeed, you are violating individual rights by having non-objective laws. And of course, the regulations are to start off with non-objective, to start off with they're not protecting rights. And as a consequence, when you see these regulatory agencies growing and growing and growing, you know the freedom in America is shrinking, shrinking, and shrinking. If you want to ask the presidential candidates, or you want to rate our presidential candidates based on one parameter, this would be a good one. We should ask them, Donald Trump, Rubio, Walker, Ted Cruz, Rand Paul, all of them. Ask them their opinion about the regulatory state, but ask them specifically, Fox or CNN, please, what would you do with all the bank regulators? What would you do with the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which is Elizabeth Warren's baby coming out of Dodd-Frank? What would you do with the SEC? What would you do with the FDA? What would you do with the EPA? What would you do with all these regulatory agencies? That would be one of my first questions. How do we rein them in? How would you rein these non-objective rights-violating entities? And the point that John Cochran is making, which I find really interesting, because John is an economist, and you'd expect him to make an economic efficiency point. But that's not the point he's making. What he's making is a political freedom point. What he's saying is that the growth of the regulatory agencies, this non-objective law, has created a situation which is restricting freedom of speech, which is restricting political freedoms. It's restricting people's ability, people's willingness to express themselves about politics, about the regulations, about the role of the state. It's a means, and here's a sentence from this. He says, the regulatory state is an ideal tool for the entrenchment of political power. And his argument is that this is the intention. This is the purpose. This is the whole reason for establishing the regulatory state. From its roots with FDR during the Great Depression, where FDR clearly used the regulations and the laws for political leverage all the way to today. And he says, you know, the economic argument against regulation has been made. It's kind of obvious. There's no question, particularly in the day of today with technology and with free flow of information and our ability to rate companies like Uber and restaurants through Yelp and all this other stuff. Do we really need regulators to tell us that the taxi is safe? But that's not why regulations exist. Regulations exist in order to control us. And more importantly, the point Cochran is making is regulations exist in order for those in power to maintain their power, to use the regulations to silence us. The rule of law, the original sense of the rule of law, and I'm quoting Cochran here, ultimately is a set of restrictions to keep the state from using its awesome power to coerce, to force your political support. Now, this echoes Ayn Rand, right? It echoes Ayn Rand. The rule of law is there to protect your rights. It's to protect you from the awesome power of coercion that the government can inflict on you. That's what the rule of law is there for. That's what objective law is there for. And we have come a long, long, long way from that. Now, there's a lot of technicalities to the issue of the rule of law. Separation of powers, things like the right to counsel, the right to an appeal, the right to question witnesses, the right to discovery. All these things are the technicalities that make it possible for you to appeal, to challenge, to actually have your day in court when you are accused of something. And even these things are denied of you through the regulatory state. Because the regulators don't give you all these abilities to question them, to challenge them. All this doesn't actually exist. All right, if you have any questions, comments, if you've experienced the rule of law, the decay in the rule of law, if you've experienced the tyranny of the regulators, the tyranny of the bureaucrats, call in 347-324-3075, 347-324-3075. Somebody on the chat here is mentioning that the rule of law is ensures forced altruism, forced equality. It's there for that. It's that, but it's a lot more. And I'll talk about why it's that in a minute. But it's a lot more. It takes advantage of the fact that epistemologically, we don't expect clarity anymore. We don't expect reason anymore. We don't expect to understand the rules. We don't expect to understand the regulations. Epistemologically, we've been so, dumbed down? We've been told over and over again that we're just idiots living in a cave watching our own shadows. And then we need the philosopher kings to make sense of the world. And how are we supposed to understand the regulations? We're too stupid. We need the experts. This is the Platonic, the Plato's philosopher kings. Plato's philosopher kings imposing themselves on us. And we're not expected to question anything because we've been taught. We've been taught over and over and over again that we cannot challenge. We cannot understand. And to hook up to the point made earlier, it's in the public good. And who knows what the public good is, by the way? Any of you know what the public good is? Who has knowledge into what's good for the public? Who has knowledge into what's good for society? Well, the philosopher kings, the Paul Krugmans of the world, the Stiglitzes of the world, the Obamas of the world, the intelligentsia, the people who know, they know because they're hooked in to the common good. And it's okay for them to make a lot of money and preach about equality because they are not equal. And it's okay that they are not equal. Everybody else, those needs to be equal, particularly those damn materialistic, stupid, base businessmen who need to be regulated and controlled. So this really is epistemological. It's moral. It's driven by egalitarianism, by hatred of success. It's driven by altruism, by the notion that everybody needs to be protected from those egoistic, selfish, self-interested businessmen. We need to be protected from Uber. We need to be protected from restaurants. We need to be protected from our contractors. We need to be protected, period. We are too stupid, incompetent, irrational to protect ourselves. Government is there to think for us because we cannot think for ourselves. I mean, the audacity of this approach. Of course, it's never said like this, but this is Plato's philosophy in action. These are the philosopher kings in action, sitting at the FDA, sitting at the SEC, telling us what information we can reveal to whom and when, telling us what's fair and what's right, telling shareholders that not to worry, they are being protected, they can be stupid if they want, telling parents not to worry about the education of their parents. They can be stupid if they want because the government will take care of that education. Taking depositors. Don't worry. You can deposit your money. You're too stupid to figure out whether the bank is worth, is risky or not. So we'll give you deposit insurance and we'll regulate the bank for you. Don't worry. Be happy. Be stupid. Sit in the cave. Watch shadows. Pretend you know something. Watch your reality television. Worry about Bruce Jenner, and let us worry about the important things. Let us protect you and keep you safe. Not protect your rights. Protect you. Mother you. Paternalize you. Can you paternalize somebody? That's probably grammatically wrong. Sorry, guys. Government as a parent, we as incompetent idiots. Government as philosopher kings, we as in chains in a cave, watching our own shadows. That's where we are today. All of history is a battle between Aristotle and Plato, and God, is Plato winning right now? Aristotle is losing right now. Only voice, the only modern voice representing Aristotle, the only modern voice defending reason is Ayn Rand. Read Ayn Rand, read Atlas Shrugged, read The Virtue of Selfishness, Capitalism, Not Known Ideal. And if you haven't gone to ARI campus, go today and listen to some philosophy that can liberate us, really the only philosophy that can liberate us from Plato's Republic.
Selfishness, a virtue? It is according to the moral principles of objectivism. Conventional morality tells you to sacrifice your values to satisfy the needs of others. Ayn Rand opposes that view and offers a new concept of egoism, an ethics of rational selfishness that rejects sacrifice in all its forms. In The Virtue of Selfishness, Ayn Rand defies conventional thought, setting out a philosophy that holds man as a heroic being, with his own happiness as the moral purpose of his life. Explore Rand's new concept of egoism and order The Virtue of Selfishness at Amazon.com today.
You didn't build that. You don't pay your fair share. Who do you think you are? Ayn Rand knew exactly who you are. Rational, productive, independent. You work hard and use your own judgment. You choose your career path, your lifestyle, your values. You're living the American dream. And now you see that there are people who want to take away what you've created and who will call their lust to loot a virtue. People who think the needs of others is a claim on your money, your work, your life. Well, how can you fight back? That's what they do at the Ayn Rand Institute. They look closely at public policy beyond sound bites and election cycles, at the fundamental moral ideas that frame crucial debates. They focus on reframing the issues in line with reason, egoism, and individual rights to life, liberty, property, and the pursuit of happiness. Your life, liberty, property, and the pursuit of your happiness. Stand up with them to fight against the sacrifice of your values by making a contribution today at AynRand.org/support. They'll use your money to defend your values.
The Ayn Rand Institute's mission is to promote Ayn Rand's philosophy of reason, rational self-interest, and laissez-faire capitalism. We are currently looking for talented, passionate, and bright people who share our goal of advancing Ayn Rand's ideas in the world. The Ayn Rand Institute offers you the opportunity to impact the culture and make a difference each and every day. If you're interested in working at the Ayn Rand Institute, visit us at AynRand.org today. There you'll find details on employment opportunities and how to apply.
Ayn Rand was a radical thinker whose philosophical novels challenged students to reconsider their views on fundamental issues. The Fountainhead, Atlas Shrugged, and Anthem. These works have become classics of American literature that never fail to engage young people and stimulate intense classroom discussion. By offering these works for free to teachers, the Ayn Rand Institute hopes to encourage greater awareness and understanding of Rand's stimulating perspective. If you're a teacher who would like Ayn Rand's books in your classroom, visit AynRand.org. This is at no cost to you. Go to AynRand.org today.
For 30 years, the Ayn Rand Institute has been on the front lines of the culture wars, introducing millions of students to Ayn Rand's books and ideas, educating young intellectuals who now teach at universities around the world, and speaking out in defense of free speech, free markets, and free minds. You can join our battle for reason, individualism, and capitalism by making your contribution today at AynRand.org/support.
We are talking rule of law and the regulatory bureaucratic tyranny that we live under today. And this is the Iran Brook Show. You can call in 347-324-3075. Let us know your thoughts on the state of the world we live in today. I'm particularly referring right now to this fabulous article by the grumpy economist, John Cochrane, who claims not to be grumpy, by the way. It's called Rule of Law in the Regulatory States. I highly recommend it. And we've got another call that we're going to take before we continue. Hi, this is you're on the Iran Brook Show. Who's this?
This is Al. How you doing?
Hey, Al. Where are you calling from?
Springfield, Illinois.
All right. What's up?
Hey, I listen to your show a lot. This is my second time calling in. I love your show. I agree with you on... You know, I've been saying this for like almost 30 years now. I absolutely agree with it. A couple of weeks ago, there was one that I disagreed with you on. There's a talk in the show. Somebody called in and said, you know, basically, because of the economy, you believe in that ever-growing pie, and they believe in a static pie where one person's gain equals another person's loss. And you, of course, believe in the ever-growing pie. And I thought that was like conceding the collectivist idea that there's only a single economic pie to have. And more from an objectivist point of view, it's everybody has their own individual pie. And that size of that pie in a properly free and rights-protecting society determines the size of that pie for that individual, you know, through your effort.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. So I misspoke. Thanks for picking that up and correcting me. We bake our own pies. We make them as big as we can make them. My point was that in baking one's pie, you're not taking anything from somebody else. That is, the total number of pies and the total size of all the pies that we as individuals can create is ever growing and is infinite in size. There's no limit to how big it can be. So there's
every person creates their own wealth. And so my only concern was that you were kind of conceding the collectivist view of a single pie. And so
Right. And if I did concede that by implication, my fault. Thanks for catching it. Thanks for letting me know. And I will try to behave next time.
All right.
Great. Right. Thanks for calling in and thanks for listening. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right. So let's get back to rule of law. You know, it's hard sometimes, particularly when these metaphors are bounced around. And metaphors are very dangerous. It's very, very difficult to give good metaphors and to stick to good metaphors and to really analyze good metaphors. Is really even an individual pie a good metaphor? Do we really bake our wealth creation? I mean, it's tricky to have metaphors and to try to make intellectual arguments using metaphors. And it's very easy. So this is a general comment. I don't advise you to use metaphors generally. I mean, once in a while to explain stuff, it's good. But the more we use them, the more we're likely to get into trouble. And the pie analogy is good. It's true that there's no fixed pie that we divvy it up between people. But it's also true that there's not one big, huge pie that keeps growing. They're individual pies, but it's not even individual pies. It's wealth, and creating wealth is a complex and interesting activity that is, when we simplify it in terms of explaining it as just a pie, we don't completely capture it. So anyway, beware of metaphors, and who are well practiced at this, slip into making these kind of mistakes with metaphors once in a while, in particular when answering a call or when discussing it with somebody, and you adopt their metaphor, you got to watch it. You got to be careful. All right. By the way, if you call in and you want to ask a question, I think you have to press one of the buttons there to let me know that you want to ask a question. If you don't know how to do that and you're on the chat and you want to ask a question, then let me know in the chat that you're calling to ask a question, and I'll hook you up. All right, so let's go over a little bit about this about some of these ridiculous, non-objective, tyrannical ways in which regulators impose themselves on the markets and particularly on the banking industry. One of my favorite industries, as many of you know. I'm a huge supporter and proponent of the financial industry. I think it's crucial to capitalism. You cannot have a free market without a thriving banking and financial industry. It might be the most important industry in a free economy. It is, in many respects, the heart of capitalism, the blood supply, it's how we feed capitalism. So I'm a huge fan, and I'll do, I promise still, that I will do a whole show on banking and finance. I've got a product coming out soon, and when we launch it, we'll be talking a lot about banks and about the importance of finance and banking. But I just want to, in the context of the bureaucratic tyranny, the tyranny of the bureaucrats, the tyranny of the regulators, I want to talk a little bit about banks, for example, and I could go on and on and on with this, but let me give you some examples. So in the Dodd-Frank piece of legislation, which is 2,300 pages long, Atlas Shrugged times two, but you know, with just rules and rules and rules. But note this. That the 2,300 pages in Dodd-Frank don't actually articulate the rules under which banks should act. That is left for the regulators to articulate. So for every few pages in Dodd-Frank, there are then thousands of pages of regulations. I mentioned before, the Volcker rule, which I don't know how many pages captures in Dodd-Frank, but not 2,300, a few, turns into 1,000 pages of rules from the regulators. And it's not even just one regulator. Every bank in the United States today is regulated by 7 different regulators who all have a rule book, who all get to say what the regulations are going to be. The Fed, the OCC, the FDIC, the SEC, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, state regulators, and did I say the SEC? Anyway, I forgot the 7th. All right, if I didn't say the SEC, then SEC is the 7th. If I did, I forgot the 7th. But anyway, think about what that means. Think about what a banker has to hold in his mind. Think about every decision he makes. John Cochran writes here, and he's absolutely right. The regulators must give their okay on every major decision of the banks. Regulators go to work at the banks, hundreds of them, at every major bank in the United States. They have offices next to CEO because they have to sign off on everything. And then people tell me the financial crisis was caused by unregulated banks. Really? Where is this fantasy land where they are unregulated banks? Because I don't know of it. Hey, there's immense discretion even after these thousands of rules, of pages. For example, there is no definition of systemic. Now, a huge deal was made about systemic risk and banks with systemic risk, or just generally companies with systemic risk. It turns out that the systemic risk, oh, that's the 7th agency. Sorry, whoa, how did I forget that one? The 7th agency is the Systemic Risk Commission, which evaluates you about whether you have systemic risk or not. But they have gone well beyond banks, insurance companies, other financial companies, potentially non-financial companies. Who has systemic risk? But what is systemic? There is no definition for systemic. There is no, because I think it's impossible to have one. So if the Systemic Risk Agency defines you as a systemic risky business with all the regulations and controls and limitations that that entails, you can't challenge that. By what standard do you challenge it? It's an arbitrary standard to begin with. So there's nothing you can do. This is non-objective law. This is the end of the rule of law in America. And nobody cares. That's the thing, right? I'm yelling here. I'm getting all excited. Maybe a few of you upset. Some of you are talking about, I don't know, reality television maybe. This is killing us. This isn't just Yaron Brooks' fancy, you know, John Cochran's fears. These ideas, these regulatory agencies, this non-objectivity is literally going to kill us as a country, going to kill us as individuals, going to kill us as businessmen, going to kill progress and innovation and success. It's unbelievably destructive. Stress tests. All banks now have to undergo stress. Well, how do you do that? What are the standards? Who gets to determine the standards? Well, it's the Federal Reserve is going to do it, but how? Can you prepare for them? The scenarios that they test are different every single time they test them. And it's just a bunch of clever NBAs putting these things together. Do they really understand? Do they really know what the real risks are? How did they do before the financial crisis in evaluating risk? Not very well. And by the way, this is another point, a practical point. It's not a deeply philosophical point, but it's implication of all this. Who do you think is smarter? The guys working at these financial institutions or the regulators? Who's smarter? Who is more likely to outwit the other? Who's more likely? I mean, these regulators are the dumb ones. This is the real danger that we have. We've got stupid people pretending they're philosopher kings. Now there's a soundbite that even Donald Trump would be proud of, right? We are today ruled by stupid people thinking they are philosopher kings. If you're really, really bright, if you're really, really, really smart, and really, really productive, then you don't go into politics, and you certainly don't become a regulator. Regulators are typically power-lusting mediocrities. Regulators, and you can quote me on this, are power-lusting mediocrities. The real talent doesn't go into regulation, they go into creating wealth. Now, define talent. If you have a talent for controlling people, if you have an eagerness to rule over people, if you have an eagerness to control their lives, then you go become a regulator, and maybe because you're smart, you become a successful regulator. But my point is this. These guys are not that smart for the most part. They're like second. They're the kids who got the C's and the B's. The guys who got the A's on Wall Street making money and finding the regulatory loopholes to be able to make the money and creating products that make the regulations irrelevant because they allow you to go around the regulations. All right, we're going to take another call, and we're going to after this call, we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back. You're all listening to your Ron Brooks Show. Who's this on the line? Hello, you're on the line.
Hello, this is Eric.
Hey, Eric, how are you?
Hi, Ron. I met you in Peking University in China some months ago.
Oh, wow, okay. And where are you calling in from now?
I'm in the States right now. I'm in New Hampshire. I'm going to go back to China soon.
Okay.
But I heard a couple months ago you said you had a China announcement, but I never got that.
I can't remember if we had a China announcement yet, and things are still in play, but there is a couple of things that are happening in China. One is that there's going to be an Ayn Rand essay contest in China. Run by Unirol, which is the Chinese think tank in Beijing. You might want to contact them and get information about the essay contest in Chinese for the Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged. And then the other thing that we haven't announced yet, but is coming down the pipe, is probably a seminar on business ethics for Chinese businessmen and entrepreneurs that we're probably going to do in January, and I might come to China for that. So I'll keep you updated. And if you follow me on Twitter and on Facebook, you'll get all that information. So you can just put my name on Twitter and on Facebook, and I'll be letting people know about that on there.
Mm-hmm. Okay, it sounds good, but I'm just curious how that will work with the new restrictions in China. You know, President Xi has been cracking down on
freedom of speech.
Speech there more than before. You know,
yes, I know. I don't know. We will see. The Unirol, which is the free market institute in Beijing, thinks they can get away with it, but we will find out. And if they can't, then we'll have to cancel it or do something different. We'll see whether I go to China or not. It will depend partially on whether I feel safe there or not. So. I'll be asking people before I go. I'll be inquiring. So maybe you can send me your contact information by Twitter or Facebook, and I can ask you as well in terms of safety in China. All right, Eric.
Okay. Yeah.
Sounds good.
I had a question about rule of law.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Have you heard about the so-called reforms to have rule of law in China?
Well, but the fact that you're saying so-called reforms, I'm assuming it's also going to be so-called rule of law.
Yeah.
Yes, no, I think by definition in China. You see, by definition in China. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's what they say. The media in China says rule of law, but... So you read between the lines, rule by law.
Yes, and let's say by this, you cannot have rule of law in China. And the reason you cannot have rule of law in China, there are a couple of things. One is because the state has absolute power. There's no constitution There's no mechanism by which to rein in the power of the state. And one of the best illustrations of this is the fact that in China, there's no independent judiciary. You cannot have a rule of law without an independent judiciary. And so basically, it's rule of men in China who give you the pretense that, and they tell you here the rules, but they could change the rules anytime. And you have no recourse. Right. You have no way to challenge that. So China cannot have the rule of law as long as it's an authoritarian regime.
Right. And actually, there really isn't any rules. I mean, there are laws on the books, but those laws are very flexible. And it's the law, the rule is whatever the party official says it is.
So that's becoming
it doesn't matter what's written.
Like the United States. That's becoming exactly like the United States. And that's, you know, China is at least somewhat moving in the right direction. The United States used to have the rule of law and is abandoning it in a speedy way. And it's, you know, and if you live in America, it is very, very scary. But thanks, Eric. Thanks for calling. And thanks for letting us in on what's going on in China. China, a country that fascinates me, and I'm always interested in what's going on here. All right, we are going to be back in 3 minutes to continue our discussion and maybe shift it a little bit to some other topics. And then don't forget that at the end of every show,
Ayn Rand was a radical thinker whose philosophical novels challenged students to reconsider their views on fundamental issues. The Fountainhead, Atlas Shrugged, and Anthem. These works have become classics of American literature that never fail to engage young people and stimulate intense classroom discussion. By offering these works for free to teachers, the Ayn Rand Institute hopes to encourage greater awareness and understanding of Rand's stimulating perspective. If you're a teacher who would like Ayn Rand's books in your classroom, visit AynRand.org. This is at no cost to you. Go to AynRand.org today.
When The Fountainhead was first published more than 70 years ago, Ayn Rand's bold literary vision and groundbreaking philosophy of individualism captured the world's attention. Initially rejected by 12 publishers as too intellectual, the novel became an instant classic and continues to provoke heated debates. What motivates a creative thinker? Is it a selfless desire to benefit mankind, a hunger for fame, fortune, and accolades, the need to prove superiority, or is it a self-sufficient drive to pursue a creative vision independent of others' needs or opinions? Ayn Rand addresses these questions through her portrayal of Howard Roark, an innovative architect who, as she puts, struggles for the integrity of his creative work against every form of social opposition. It's also the story of his love affair with a woman who seeks to defeat him. The Fountainhead is as relevant today as it was when Rand first penned it. The novel was also a personal landmark for Rand. In Howard Roark, she presented for the first time the uniquely Ayn Rand hero, man as he could be and ought to be. Order your copy today at Amazon.com.
You didn't build that. You don't pay your fair share. Who do you think you are? Ayn Rand knew exactly who you are. Rational, productive, independent. You work hard and use your own judgment. You choose your career path, your lifestyle, your values. You're living the American dream. And now you see that there are people who want to take away what you've created and who will call their lust to loot a virtue. People who think the needs of others is a claim on your money, your work, your life. Well, how can you fight back? That's what they do at the Ayn Rand Institute. They look closely at public policy beyond sound bites and election cycles, at the fundamental moral ideas that frame crucial debates. They focus on reframing the issues in line with reason, egoism, and individual rights to life, liberty, property, and the pursuit of happiness. Your life, liberty, property, and the pursuit of your happiness. Stand up with them to fight against the sacrifice of your values by making a contribution today at AynRand.org/support. They'll use your money to defend your values.
Meet your fellow Ayn Rand admirers from around the country for an evening celebrating the ideas of Atlas Shrugged. Join them on the evening of September 29th at the St. Regis Hotel in Manhattan for the 7th annual Atlas Shrugged Revolution Benefit Dinner and Live Auction. More than 5 decades after its publication, Atlas Shrugged continues to influence millions of people, and each year thousands more are introduced to and forever changed by Ayn Rand's magnum opus. Find out why and how the Ayn Rand Institute is promoting Rand's ideas throughout the United States and around the world. You'll be supporting the work of the Ayn Rand Institute to encourage even more young people to read and study Ayn Rand's novels in the years ahead. Visit online at AynRand.org/NYC or call us toll-free at 800-365-6552, extension 204. Seating is limited, so make sure to call or go online. That's A-Y-N-R-A-N-D.org rand.org/NYC or call 800-365-6552, extension 204.
All right, we're back. This is your on Brook Show. We're talking about objective law, rule of law. We're talking about the decline, the spiraling out of control decline of rule of law in the United States with the rise of the authoritarian regulatory state. And Liran has been trying to call in for a while, so we're going to take a call here from Liran. Liran, hi, you're on the Iran Brook Show. How are things in Argentina? I barely hear you. You're breaking up.
It's fine.
Wait.
1 second.
You're breaking up. Try again, Liran.
No.
That's better. Right. All right. Unfortunately, Liran's breaking up, so I cannot take his call. We'll have to try. We'll have to try again another time. So we've talked about all this in the context of kind of financial regulation and so on. But I'd like to now step back to discuss kind of the incredible financial turmoil that happened over the last week and a half, and at least discuss one aspect of it. There is an aspect that relates to China, which I'm not going to discuss today. We just don't have the time to get into the whole China question, even though Eric was on the line. And you know what I'll have to do is do another show on China and the whole economic issues around China. And I might do that if you're really interested. You know, I do a show right after this. And those of you who are listening to this not live, you can get this off of iTunes, off of Blog Talk Radio as well. My Chicago show, my AM560, The Answer show. And I'm probably going to do that show just on China today. So you can catch my views on China and the effect China had on the whole market turmoil, on the whole market turmoil thing. But what I'd like to discuss today is another aspect of the market turmoil. And I want to link it up to this idea of rule of law, non-objective law. And just a whole non-objectivity of the state of the world right now. It's just I find it just particularly horrific. So let me do this. So this is we've got another call, but let me just make this point, and then I'll take the call, and then we'll see how much time we have for the positive value of the day. Federal Reserve is meeting this weekend at Jackson Hole. And much of the market turmoil related to the speculation about whether the Fed was going to increase interest rates or not increase interest rates. And what happened in China only kind of made that speculation more acute and only exacerbated the response to that speculation. So here is a regulatory institution, a government institution, an institution of coercion called the Federal Reserve, who gets together on a regular basis, 12 guys, a few gals there. There's at least one, Janet Yellen, who heads up the Federal Reserve, and who get to decide what interest rates are going to be. How do they decide? Well, they've got these massive models, and they've got economic theories, and they run regressions, and they do all kinds of sophisticated modeling. And they decide based on economic theories, almost all of which have been proven to be wrong. One example of this, there was an article in the Wall Street Journal, I think last week or the week before. Here it is. It was on, what's the date? There's no date. Oh, there it is. August 23rd. And the article says, this is the title of the article. The Fed has a theory. Trouble is, the proof is patchy. Now, he's being generous. There is no proof, patchy or not. The subtitle is, as central banks ponder raising rates, it looks to the Phillips curve. The Phillips curve, a curve that has been discredited for decades. But they make it more sophisticated. They make it more mathematical. They change the variables. They fit the graphs. They make it work somehow. And they rationalize it. They rationalize it. And whether you think the Fed should increase interest rates or not, They have no objective basis to do so. All other central banks. Because central bankers are central planners. Central bankers are more philosopher kings with arbitrary power. There is no way to tell what the interest rate should be. The interest rate should be determined by the supply of savings versus the demand for lending, for loans. It should be the intersection of the supply and demand curve, should dictate interest rates, and it should move based on changing values within a society, changing time preferences within a society, individual time preferences, as aggregated through a market process, changing risk tolerance in a market system would change interest rates. As I said, risk preferences, type preferences, preferences for consumption versus preferences for saving. All of that both would feed into the determination of an interest rate and help shape, given what the interest rate is. If interest rates are high, you would tend to shift your preferences towards more saving and less consumption. But that would have an impact on interest rates, that shift. Interest rates are continuously moving based on individuals, individual preferences. And nobody, not the smartest person in the world or a computer, can mimic that, not because of, as Hayek would argue, limitations on reason, that is epistemologically corrupt. No, but because you cannot evaluate my objective values. They're objective to me. They're my values. You can't know them. The only way the market knows them is through my behavior. I buy bread. They know that I buy bread at $2. I don't buy bread at $3. In that sense, the marketplace knows my preferences with regard to bread. But they can't look inside my mind. So how would they know what the right price of bread is other than based on my all of our demand and supplies for bread? So central planning is impossible because, not because, again, limitations of reason or limitation of computational power. It's impossible because values are individual. Only individuals have values, and there's no way to aggregate them. So the Federal Reserve is trying to do the impossible. It's trying to set a correct interest rate. There is no correct interest rate. And they cannot be a central planner. Therefore, they cannot be a Federal Reserve. Now, this is another massively random, non-objective element within our economy that skews the stock market, that skews economic activity, that distorts everything that we do. I mean, I think interest rates are artificially low right now. And by holding them artificially low, it creates massive distortions and perversions in the marketplace, including in the stock market. But who knows? We don't have a free market, so we don't know what the real rate of interest would be in a truly free market if there was no Federal Reserve artificially manipulating it. And what is the right interest rates, even if it's too low today? How much should it be raised? I don't know. I have no idea. And nobody knows that. Nobody can know. So talk about non-objective. Talk about the lack of the rule of law. Talk about the lack of predictability. So no wonder there's volatility in the stock market. No wonder there's uncertainty in the world. The most powerful financial institution in the world, the one that embodies the most systemic risk ever in human history. No institution has had more systemic risk than the Federal Reserve of the United States. When it sneezes, everybody pays attention because they are likely to catch the flu. And it might be deadly flu, as we had in the financial crisis. So the non-objectivity of our regulatory state has massive consequences. And the Federal Reserve is one illustration of that, even though technically Well, it is a regulatory agency, but it's money printing, interest rate setting responsibilities are not technically regulation, but they're the same thing. Same thing. Arbitrary power by the regulated philosopher kings. All right, we've got another call. Hi, who's this? You're on Brooke Show.
Hi, this is Tom. Can you hear me?
Yes, Tom, I can hear you fine. What's up?
Oh, good, good. I got two things. Years ago, if you'll remember, there were a multitude, almost 100 Chinese students over the years entering the essay contest. They won $50 as runner-ups. I recommend you do the same thing. I went to the International School of Beijing and talked to some of the teachers, and one of the teachers made it a class assignment to enter the Anthem essay contest.
Excellent. Yes, that's wonderful.
Yeah.
Now, Tom, where are you calling from?
Thing. Las Vegas.
Okay. Yeah, one other thing. But you lived in China, I take it?
I lived in Taiwan and Hong Kong with extensive trips into China for almost 15 years.
Okay, wow.
Until the communists decided that I was unpopular and kicked me out of Hong Kong.
Okay,
I was dangerous.
Wow.
Okay, now, the other thing you mentioned was central planning. One of the things I've always done is made a challenge. Anybody, you know, I'll put up $1,000, anybody that can arrange 10 books on a shelf in a sequence to my liking, we'll get the $1,000.
Yep.
And you understand that's about 3,628,800 combinations.
Absolutely.
And that
that's
would take
perfect.
Years to do, and anybody would, to take that up would have to be stupid.
Now, I don't know the math, but what would it take to arrange the books in every bookshelf for every human being on the planet? I mean, that's what central planning is about. That's true.
But nobody's going to take up that as a matter of foolishness. Whereas if you offer 10 books, it's only 10 books.
Yep.
So, yep. But nobody's going to actually, most people are not going to figure out that that's 10 factorial.
Absolutely. So no, you're absolutely right. And that is the point. The point is it's your values, the order that you like. And for somebody else to figure that out is one in whatever the number you gave of probability.
It's impossible.
And, of course, the central planner has to do that over the entire population,
right?
Which is impossible. And of course, your preferences are changing over time. And your preferences are changing over time. They're not even static.
Yeah. So that's a practical challenge that will emphasize the fact that when you try and do it on a large scale, it's even more impossible.
No, excellent. Thanks a lot. That is a great way to concretize the problem. So I appreciate it. Thanks a lot, Tom. Thanks for calling. Thanks for listening to the show. And someday we'll have to talk about why they kicked you out of Hong Kong. I'm sure there's an amazing story there somewhere. All right. So somebody on the chat here is saying, I don't understand your obsession with regulators. Just bribe them. That is what they want, or get yourself elected. Well, just bribe them. A, bribing costs money. Bribing costs money, which you might not have, right? That's ridiculous. The whole blackmailing them is ridiculous. It places some people at a huge disadvantage over other people. And that's exactly the kind of world we don't want to live in. And that's exactly what happens, right? What happens is we have to bribe them. But how's that good? How's that a world you want to live in? How's that a world which anybody should want to live in? Where the standard of success is bribery. The standard of success is who can get away with it. That's a horrible world. That's a world before the establishment of America. That's the world of the robber barons. And that's a world I don't want to live in. That's a world I'm willing to fight against. But that's the world that we're heading towards. The tyranny where to survive, you have to bribe. That's the Middle East. America's not the Middle East. Never used to be the Middle East, and should never be the Middle East. And it's not even all the Middle East. You don't get a head in Israel by bribing people, because it's civilized. The whole point of civilization is to eliminate the need to bribe, the need to blackmail. Now, yes, there's some bribing in Israel. There's some bribing in the United States. There's some of this that goes on, but that's not the dominant. Because if it was the dominant, you wouldn't have economic progress. You wouldn't have economic success. And yes, you can find third world countries that are doing okay because of bribery, but they would not be doing okay if not for the United States still being relatively free, if not for other countries still being relatively free. The third world would collapse. These pseudo-economies would collapse, as many of them are. Look at Venezuela, right? Venezuela is a country built on the principle of bribery. You know, we have to fight against the regulators. We have to fight against the use of force, the arbitrary use of force. We have to fight against the violation of our rights. We have to fight for something. We have to fight for freedom. Yeah. Even countries in the West have bribery as endemic. It ain't good, and those countries aren't as rich as they could be. And indeed, if the rich countries disappeared, they would collapse. Italy would be Greece. No, it's not. The world is unfair. The world sucks. You have to fight against it. I'm not here to give in to the world being unfair. I'm here to fight against the unfairness of the world. Because the unfairness of the world is dictated by ideology, and it's dictated by education, and it's dictated by politicians. And if you want to fight it, you have to change people's ideas. Ideas make the world unfair. Ideas allow for the tyranny of the bureaucrats and the regulators. And ideas are the way in which we will liberate ourselves. And for a movie recommendation related to some of the topics we've discussed today, or at least to the financial side of this, stay tuned right after the break.
With adoring fans, rabid critics, and very few in between, why does Atlas Shrugged evoke such impassioned responses? Because it grapples with the fundamental problems of human existence, and it presents radically new answers. Atlas Shrugged challenges many conventional notions about good and evil, that sex is a low animal desire, that money is the root of evil, that man is sinful by nature. One of the most prominent is the notion that selfishness is evil and self-sacrifice is good. Atlas Shrugged is a dramatization of Ayn Rand's unique vision of existence and of man's highest potential. 12 years in the writing, it is her masterwork. Rand's worldview emerges in the plot turns of this compelling mystery, centered on one question: who is John Galt? There are many legends. Which of these is true? Is he the man who discovered the Fountain of Youth? The man who found the lost city of Atlantis? A modern Prometheus? Does he even exist? And why, if no one knows the answer, does the entire world know his name? Find out the answer when you read the novel that sparked a philosophical revolution. Order it today on Amazon.com.
The Ayn Rand Institute campus is an exciting online destination offering free e-courses on Ayn Rand and her revolutionary philosophy of objectivism. Whether you recently picked up your first Rand book or have been reading her novels and nonfiction for years, ARI Campus has something for you. On campus, you'll discover a variety of multimedia courses covering Rand's literary classics, specific aspects of thought, and how to apply her ideas to your life. Get started today at campus.aynrand.org. See you on campus.
In 1934, Ayn Rand wrote to journalist and essayist H.L. Mencken, "Perhaps it may seem a lost cause at present, and there are those who will say that I am too late, that I can only hope to be the last fighter for a mode of thinking which has no place in the future. But I do not think so. I intend to be the first one in a new battle, which the world needs as it has never needed before, the first to answer the many too many advocates of collectivism and answer them in a manner which will not be forgotten. Every day at ARI, we work to make sure that Ayn Rand's answer will not be forgotten. Help us. Contribute today at AynRand.org/support.
The Ayn Rand Institute's mission is to promote Ayn Rand's philosophy of reason, rational self-interest, and laissez-faire capitalism. We are currently looking for talented, passionate, and bright people who share our goal of advancing Ayn Rand's ideas in the world. The Ayn Rand Institute offers you the opportunity to impact the culture and make a difference each and every day. If you're interested in working at the Ayn Rand Institute, visit us at AynRand.org today. There you'll find details on employment opportunities and how to apply.
Meet your fellow Ayn Rand admirers from around the country for an evening celebrating the ideas of Atlas Shrugged. Join them on the evening of September 29th at the St. Regis Hotel in Manhattan for the 7th Annual Atlas Shrugged Revolution Benefit Dinner and Live Auction. More than 5 decades after its publication, Atlas Shrugged continues to influence millions of people, and each year thousands more are introduced to and forever changed by Ayn Rand's magnum opus. Find out why and how the Ayn Rand Institute is promoting Rand's ideas throughout the United States and around the world. You'll be supporting the work of the Ayn Rand Institute to encourage even more young people to read and study Ayn Rand's novels in the years ahead. Visit online at aynrand.org/NYC or call us toll free at 800-365-6552, extension 204. Seating is limited, so make sure to call or go online. That's aynrand.org/NYC or call 800-365-6552, extension 204.
You know, I get excited about this stuff, where I get passionate about it, where I start yelling. Somebody on the chat called it enthusiasm. It's because I care about my life. It's because I love my life. It's because I want to have the best life possible in this world. I don't want to waste my time, my energy, my resources on a BS that is created by these regulators, by these tyrants. I don't want to live under threat, which I feel I am today. And I don't want to live with limited opportunities. We all need to get excited. We all need to be passionate. We all need to fight this because we love our life. Now, looks like I'm running a little late. So I wanted to recommend a couple of pro-business movies to you. One is an older movie. One is a less older movie. All the movies I recommend are kind of old. So here's a couple that I would suggest. One is it's called Other People's Money. I don't know how many of you have seen Other People's Money. It's with Danny DeVito, and it's with Gregory Peck. It's one of my favorite business-related movies, and it's about hostile takeovers, and it's about the role of the financier and the importance of the financier. And I would encourage you all to watch this movie. It's a great conflict between the Danny DeVito character and the Gregory Peck character. Gregory Peck, in my world, is the bad guy, and Danny DeVito is the good guy, which is very, very, very unusual and strange, but it's true. Now, the movie undercuts the good guy a little bit by making him Danny DeVito, who looks pathetic and acts pathetic, but he's brilliant. And what he says, the speeches he gives, are some of the best speeches defending finance and defending capitalism ever given. So Other People's Money, you can pretty much watch it anywhere, and it really is a fabulous movie, at least in that respect. I think it has other elements that are problematic. It's quite vulgar. And again, they try to make fun of the DeVito character by putting him into a pretty ridiculous romantic relationship. But anyway, there are very few pro-business movies anyway. So it's quite unusual to find one, and Other People's Money, I think, is one of those. I'd be curious to find out. By the way, if you like the movies I recommend, or if you have an opinion about the movies I recommend, send me an email. Let me know. You can send it through Twitter. You can send it on Facebook. You can send me an email. On Twitter, I'm Yaron Brook. On Facebook, Yaron Brook. So either way, I'd love to hear from you guys. Love to hear what you think about the show. But also, whether you enjoy the movie recommendations or what you think of any particular movie, that's on. There are a lot of other, pro-business movies. There are very few, actually. But here's another one that you might not have heard of. Other People's Money, you might have heard me recommend in the past. But this one's called Executive Suite. This is a movie from 1954, and it has William Holden, Barbara Stanwyck, and a bunch of other phenomenal actors. It's just loaded with great, 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 great actors. And, it's got, Frederick March and Walter Pidgeon and Shelley Winters. I mean, if you know old movies, you know that these are some of the great, This is a boardroom drama, a very positive boardroom drama, so I highly recommend it. And again, let me know what you think. I don't want to give it away, but basically in the opening scene, the CEO of a company drops dead. And it's a boardroom drama on who should replace him. And it really is a good movie if you can find it. This one's probably more difficult to find, but I encourage you to look for it. It's called Executive Suite. Let me just say quickly, because it's come up on the chat. I like Iron Man movies. I'm not a huge fan. Yeah, he's a businessman. Yeah, he's successful. Yeah, he's the hero. But he's also a jerk and stupid and arrogant and all kinds of other things that are just why do you have to make it that way? I guess to entertain people these days and to be consistent with because it's funny. But why is it funny to make fun of the rich guy? Why isn't it funny to make funny of other people? Anyway, I it's okay. I think the Iron Man movies, of all the superhero movies, may be my favorites. I don't like superhero movies, though, at all. And, of course, I recommended in the past, I recommend again, The Most Violent Year, which was a very good recent movie that portrayed businessmen positively. But go watch Executive Suite. Go watch Other People's Money. And I'll talk to you all next week. And if I didn't get to your call, I see somebody called here and I didn't get to their call, call again next time. And I'm sure to catch up with you. Thanks all for listening. Tell your friends about the show. It's archived. You can listen to it on iTunes, on Blog Talk Radio, on your phone, on podcast apps. See you next week.
With adoring fans, rabid critics, and very few...